Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
In our showcase studio on Michigan Avenue, a return visit from former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright. She's got a new book out called Memo to the President-Elect, How We Can Restore America's Reputation and Leadership. She's sitting right next to us again. Welcome back. It's nice to see you.
Great to be with you. Thank you so much.
So how's the tour going?
It's going very well. The book came out on Tuesday, and I was in New York, started there, and had some very nice big book signing. And then I went to Washington and had a nice big book signing there. And now I'm here in Chicago.
So all of that preceded by your standing next to Hillary Clinton in Iowa. You were there for her campaign.
I was,
yes. What did you make of Iowa? What did you make of New Hampshire?
Well, I had a fascinating time in Iowa because I'd never gone inside a caucus. And, in fact, I was surprised that I was able to do that. And watching it, you think, this is an amazing democratic process. What is interesting about it is it's really for only a limited period of time. And people have to come into a room. This was a very large gymnasium. And they have to, and they close the doors at a certain period, even if there are people outside. So, and then the people within the room begin to go into their different corners, depending upon who they're for.
Sure.
But it's not like a primary where people start voting in the morning and vote all day and their absentee ballots and things like that. So it was very interesting to watch.
Yeah, I don't know. I said at the time, I think maybe we could all borrow from them, but it's an imperfect system. It's kind of an anachronism the way I think they do it. I don't know that we're leaning in the direction of everybody going to the gym and arguing it out. We're going more computerized and electronic. That's the direction.
I honestly have to tell you, I couldn't make up my mind if it was a genuinely fabulous democratic system or not.
Yeah.
And mainly, I loved the idea of the people being in the room and talking to each other and trying to persuade each other. But the fact that it's of a limited period of time when people work, I mean, this was like, you know, 7 to 8, and people not being able to get babysitters or on the night shift, and then the military. So it's a question, but I love to see the whole process. I'm very excited by the fact that people are going to be very involved for almost a year, and that they will get more and more interested in the issues.
To what do you attribute the jump in Iowa, in New Hampshire?
I think a lot of hard work.
Think it was the quote-unquote cry?
I don't, actually. You know, what happened, first of all, I was in New Hampshire for a while myself, and I think that people were looking at the candidates and trying to figure out for a long time. And then I called into the campaign earlier in the morning, and Hillary had begun the day by saying that she was going to go visit I don't know how many polling places, and then when she was up there before, she had done a lot of question and answer sessions, and I think people got to know her a little bit.
Well, do you think the polls were wrong then?
Well, they definitely were, right? I mean, I'm not a political pundit, so I don't know how the polling was done, but they were wrong.
Is there something condescending about this whole debate about her crying and the effect that had on the electorate?
Well, the truth of the matter, she didn't cry.
Amen.
She had a time, she was asked a question, and I know her very well, and I find her to be a very compassionate and passionate and genuine person, and this was real Hillary.
Yeah, but maybe that was the story. I agree with you. Whatever that was, we've all cried, and it doesn't look like that. That was something different, but she lost her composure a little bit, and why not? But the question for me lingered was, why doesn't she show us that side more often? How difficult is it to just let her guard down, relax, breathe a little bit, cry, laugh in a way that, I don't know, somehow doesn't seem forced? I mean, that's been the criticism of Hillary Clinton.
Well, I like her very much, and I know her very well, and so I don't see her as forced or anything like that. What I see her as, she is a person who is very determined and disciplined, and she works very hard. We went to the same college. She's 10 years younger than I am, but I can visualize her there. I know how she gets her facts, how she studies, how she cares about the issues, and I think everybody is different. I think she wants to get a lot across in terms of her knowledge of issues, because she thinks that it's respectful of the electorate to really tell them what she thinks.
What do you make of John Kerry not endorsing John Edwards, but Barack Obama?
I have no idea. You know, I think people have different reasons for their endorsements. I really don't know.
Well, if I'm John Edwards, I'm ticked. They know each other better than I do, so maybe Edwards isn't surprised, but I would think that if you run for vice president, you spend that much time with the guy, you put, frankly, Edwards helped Kerry more than Kerry helped Edwards. I would think a little something for the effort here wouldn't be entirely out of line.
Well, I'm sure they have had words, or I have no idea. You know,
Oh, come on, make some news, Madeline. Say something incendiary here. Say something it was a horrible thing that he did.
I think that I was listening to some commentary, and apparently there had been some tension in that campaign. I have to tell you, though, a story that some people might not know is I live in Washington, in Georgetown, and just to tell you the geography of Georgetown, John Kennedy lived on N Street between 33rd and 34th. John Kerry lives on O Street between 33rd and 34th. And John Edwards lived on P Street between 33rd and 34th. And I live on 34th Street between N and O. And John Kerry was trying to figure out who to have as his vice presidential candidate, and it was very hard to find a private place to have a meeting without everybody tracking who he was meeting with. So I called him up and I said, you know, you can come into my house through 35th Street and nobody will know where you are. So I wasn't at my house, but John Kerry and John Edwards made their deal to be president and vice presidential candidate at that time in my house. That's much I can tell you.
But you didn't have a tape rolling to hear how the conversation played out. Like you promised me, if you help me, I'll help you. If Hillary were to win the nomination, who would you suggest she ask to be her running mate?
Well, I think she's going to have to look very carefully. I mean, what happens is there are any number of ways that people choose a vice president, and to think about, you know, what state and what experience. The only thing I would tell her is if you ask somebody to run your vice presidential search and that person names himself as vice president, you might say no.
Gee, who are you referring to there, Madam Secretary?
Well, I do think that's what happened with when George Bush asked Dick Cheney to find him a vice president.
At the time, I recall thinking that whatever your reservations were about President Bush, that he really did have an experienced team around him, and that Cheney and Rumsfeld and Powell were a good thing. Did you see this coming? Did you know that this was a disaster waiting to happen?
No, I did not. I have to say that that were various things that were happening that one had to begin to look at. I actually thought that Cheney and Rumsfeld and Powell, they had all worked together before, that they might be able to be more collegial. I had no idea that the vice president was in fact going to set up kind of a parallel system in an undisclosed location. And then I have read every book about how the decision-making process went on around how to get into the war in Iraq, and there are still mysteries to do with that, because there clearly was some channel that was a Cheney-Rumsfeld channel that Secretary Powell was not involved in.
You say that, in fact, Bush told people we're going to go to war rather than listen to whether or not we should. Is that right?
Well, I think that's what comes out of reading. The question is, what is the missing element still for me is why that was a decision. They clearly had begun to think about it a lot earlier, before 9/11. And in fact, when we were in office, Paul Wolfowitz, who then was in the Defense Department, later for Rumsfeld, had come to us in 98 and wanted us at that stage to have a ground invasion into Iraq, and we did not want to do that. I think there were some discussions, obviously, and arguments left over from the first Bush administration, and they were carried on.
Why did Wolfowitz think we should invade Iraq?
At the time, I think he thought that we should establish a beachhead for Chalabi, and that was a way to get rid of Saddam Hussein.
And it was to get rid of Saddam Hussein. Yeah.
Yes, right.
Yeah. How much of 9/11 falls then on the Clinton administration if you all were grappling with the issues of terrorism, et cetera?
Well, first of all, we were grappling with the issues of terrorism. I think that I was the lead-off witness at the 9/11 Commission, and so I went back over our record. Terrorism was definitely an issue that we looked at very seriously. President Clinton had some executive orders to do with having somebody in the White House that really looked into the issue, setting up a special section at the CIA. We foiled a number of attempts, the dogs that didn't bark. And there was a process. The worst event, I loved being Secretary of State, but my worst day was August 7th, 1998, when our embassies in Kenya and Tanzania were blown up and Osama bin Laden was fingered as the suspect. And that was when we launched cruise missiles against Afghanistan. The thing that I think people need to remember, pre-9/11, it was very hard to persuade people that there was a real danger.
Understood.
People thought we'd made it up.
Understood, but when 9/11 happened, did you have a moment where you thought we should have been more decisive before this? We should have either better alerted the people or better alerted the military or done something ourselves?
No, I'll tell you something. I mean, I feel that we did everything we could. You have to remember that 9/11 was 9 months after the Bush administration had come into office, and what had happened was that, according to everything that I read, they didn't really have a high-level meeting to talk about the danger of terrorism. We had left a number of things in place. You know what I was glad about? I got criticized a lot for all of a sudden instituting a lot of security measures around the State Department, putting up Jersey barriers and creating all kinds of entry requirements. And people thought, were critical of me for doing that. And as I drove to the office on September 11th, and I had seen the Twin Towers come down on television, and I don't know why I thought I had to go to my office, which is a private business, but when I heard that the plane had gone into the Pentagon and they were afraid that something had happened at the State Department, I thought to myself, thank God I had put up those barriers.
It's a book not for Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama or John Edwards. It's for whoever is going to hold that office, be they a Republican or a Democrat, correct?
Absolutely, because I think that people need to know how the system works, how you put a team together, but it's also a book for the American public so that they can assess the issues that are out there.
What would you say, advise me, I'm going to vote, what should be the number one thing that I would have in my head when I go shopping for a president?
That you have somebody that has confidence in their beliefs and experience, but not necessarily somebody who is totally certain about everything, so certain that they don't even know what they don't even know.
That's kind of the problem that Bush ran into, isn't it? And it still is, I think. The guy's confident. He believes that he's right. To this day, he said he would invade Iraq again. Does that shock you, that statement?
Very much so, because I think that it's very important for a president to have the capability of, first of all, naming people that have diverse ideas and not being afraid if they argue with each other. Not only that, but to elicit those kinds of arguments and then let people persuade him or her and then make up his or her mind. But the problem that I think is we can't have that certainty that doesn't allow for new information, for understanding the problems, or lack of curiosity. So I would like to have a president who is smart, experienced, listens, and has the capability of eliciting a lot of different opinions and then making up their minds.
I think Barack Obama's a lot of that, but he obviously hasn't been in the U.S. Senate that long. Should that preclude then his becoming president?
Well, I support Hillary Clinton, and I've made up my mind that I'm not criticizing other candidates. I think that this election period is going to allow the American people to examine those very qualities and qualifications. And so, while my book is directed at the president-elect, and the kind of trick in this is that it's written to you, Mr. or Madam President, to be read on election night. The bottom line is it's out now, and the reason that it's out now is that I hope that it will serve as a context for the American voter to really think about what not only what the qualifications are, but what the problems are that the next president has to deal with, and then use that book in order to answer the question that you've asked.
What's the biggest challenge the next president faces?
I think that it is restoring America's reputation, not just for the sake of that, but in order to be able to deal with the problems that are out there for the U.S., and they are, you know, just five huge ones, for instance, that require cooperation, trying to deal how to fight terrorism without creating more anti-Americanism, how to deal with the spread of nuclear weapons so that the worst weapons don't get in the hands of the worst people, to renew the good name of democracy. At the moment, democracy is identified with occupation and imperialism, to deal with the worst parts of globalization, and mitigate the gap between the rich and the poor, and to deal with that whole bundle of issues that have to do with global warming and energy. And that, just by virtue of what they are, require cooperation and a different style of working.
You think climate change is actually one of the big five things that the next president needs to worry about?
I do, and it means addressing themselves not only to those issues, but to the technology that's going to be required to have clean energy.
This whole umbrella of subjects, I think you put in an interesting way when you said we need to re-examine the brand of America. What does that represent? What does that mean? It doesn't mean we have to change it, but we need to examine what it has become, how it is it perceived. And I never thought about it that way, but America is kind of a brand to the world. And if people are associating a message different from the brand than we like, then we need to somehow tend to that problem, which is a very sort of manageable way for, I think, all of us to think about it. Well, where should we pick it up? We're talking about the brand America.
Yeah.
We were also talking off the air about election night in New Hampshire. What do you want to start with?
Let me do the brand point, because I think it's something that we don't think about very much. Americans, as we look at our history, are very proud of Bunker Hill or Omaha Beach or various victories that we've had. But you have to understand that most of the world is a very young population now. They don't know anything about those events in our history. For them, and I'm very sad to say this, the brand America is associated with Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo, and the fact that we are occupying a country. I don't agree with obviously a lot of these allegations, but you have to understand that that is the branding at the moment, and we have to show the goodness of American power.
When the world thinks of America, they think of Abu Ghraib, or at least certain people in the Middle East.
A lot of them, and, you know, not abiding by the Geneva Conventions, and the fact that we're actually having a rather peculiar debate about torture. And I have been involved with these Pew Attitude Surveys, I don't know, where we survey all over the world about what the image of America is, and it has consistently gone down. So, for instance, take an example, Turkey, which is a NATO ally and a good friend of ours. In 2000, our favorability ratings were about 52%. Now they are 9%. And the young population there and in other countries just doesn't know about what a great country we are.
Does that reflect the perception or fact? I mean, we're still a great country. We still do good things. Is it that we don't get the message out there, or is it, in fact, because we're doing bad things?
I think it's a combination of things. Iraq has really hurt our reputation.
Did Afghanistan help our reputation?
It should, I think, because I think the thing that was so interesting here, John, after 9/11, the world was with us. It was very clear that it was the world against people who fly airplanes into buildings and kill innocent people. And then when President Bush tried to magnify the cooperation or enlarge it by saying you are either with us or against us, and then had it apply also to the war in Iraq or how we talked about Iran and North Korea and a number of other issues, then we began to see that there were more and more countries and people against us.
Sure, but who are we talking to? If you're the President of the United States and you're standing in the rubble with the bullhorn, you know the world is listening, but your first audience is Americans. And if you say you're for us or against us, people cheered that sentiment.
But that was fine at the time. Believe me, it really was. I was very proud of the president, and I think he did the right thing by going after the Taliban in Afghanistan. People had, in fact, attacked the United States that had come out of there, and that was an appropriate response. Where he began to lose people was when all of a sudden they began to connect that to Iraq, and we had talked earlier about where did that come from, and when it was somehow appended to some decision that must have come out of an earlier period, and people were told that there was a connection between Osama bin Laden and Saddam Hussein, that was a step too far. And then when it is taken even further to explain that we have to fight all terrorists and that Islamo-fascism and various terms, it then creates greater and greater division.
You don't like the idea of a war on terror?
I think war on terror is the wrong word. This is really a battle of ideas, and what we have to do is present our ideas about what we are for, not just what we are all against.
Yeah, but we seem like lame ducks if we don't do something about it. Being for peace and democracy didn't keep the people from flying the planes into the buildings. Should we be proactive the way the president thinks we should, preemptively strike?
I tell you something, I spend a lot of time thinking about this, and there is criticism of the doctrine of preemption, mainly because he made a doctrine out of something that's self-evident, which is that you have the right of self-defense. But by making it a doctrine, he then said, basically, we think it's right for us to attack countries that we're afraid of. What if some other country does that? And then what he did, the doctrine of preemption is based on accurate intelligence. That is the Achilles heel of the whole process. And if you don't know what is going on in another country, or if you suspect and then the national intelligence estimate 3 years later says the Iranians don't have a nuclear program, you can't go around making decisions based on inaccurate intelligence.
But the vice president says the stakes are too high, that if there's a 1% probability, did you call it the 1% doctrine?
That was
it,
yeah.
Well, then we can't afford to guess on this. We need to err on the side of our national security. If you think Iran has nuclear capabilities, you can't wait to find out if you're right, can you?
Well, I think you have to think about the unintended consequences of foreign policy decisions. And while I believe, and I say this in my book, is that there are a set of tools. When a president becomes president, you open up the national security toolbox. What's in there? And clearly, the use of force is one of the tools, but it should be the last one, you think. And you need to think about what the consequences are of using force on Iran. I'm not saying take it off the table. I'm just saying that they have to think about it.
Well, when you were the Secretary of State, did you realize we didn't have anybody who spoke the languages of that part of the world in our FBI and CIA and Department of Defense? I thought it was amazing that the 12th of September, the head of the FBI says, if anybody speaks Urdu, give us a call. I was aghast. I was saddened. Did you realize that the infrastructure of our intelligence was that depleted?
I tell you what I did realize was that there were very bad relationships between the FBI and the CIA. One of the things we tried to do, I tried it in my office, is to bring Louis Free and George Tenet together on a regular basis. They were very proprietary about what they knew, and I think that was a real lack. And one of the things that President Clinton tried to do was to create a centralized way of dealing with fighting terrorism. Very difficult, given that you can see it now, with two very separate bureaucracies.
Two separate bureaucracies. Well, there's a lot of carryover. I mean, cabinet level positions changed, but
they are so jealous of each other. I think it's appalling.
And well, I understand that, but I mean, the current president then had the same set of problems you faced. That is, how do we get these agencies to talk to each other, and how do we, in fact, get good intelligence?
You know what, John? We at least had meetings about it. They did not have a meeting about this until, you know, just before and around 9/11. Listen to what Dick Clark, who was the guy that was in charge of this, and he complains that he really could not get a high-level meeting on this.
Well, then what do you think this was about? Was it the current president's desire to finish his father's war? 41 was criticized for ending the Persian Gulf War when we did. Do you think that they said,
I don't know.
You
know, this is the missing piece, and some of it is psychobabble over, better than his father. Some of it is that Cheney actually was the one that was controlling it. And as I told you, you know, I said earlier, I have read the books. That is the missing piece.
You haven't figured it out either?
No, definitely not.
I wonder if he's figured it out. I mean,
that may also be a question.
Is this possible that he just decided, this is my chance to make my mark on history? And how wrong can it be? They violate all the UN sanctions, and we can squash them in 48 hours. So although it was a gigantic decision, it seemed to be a very doable thing. I can see it being tempting to a person who wants to write history.
Well, I think one has to separate what the issues were about. I think Saddam Hussein was a horrible person. All the things that President Bush said, I said the same things for 8 years. The question that I think the decision makers missed on, let's go back to Afghanistan and 9/11. They, for some reason, took their eye off the ball on Afghanistan, which is where the 9/11 killers came from, and decided to shift things to Iraq. And for me, the missing question is why there were not more questions about that, because that's what made it undoable.
Did we misplace Saudi Arabia in all of this?
Well, our relations with the Saudis are so complicated. We depend on them for so many things. They had a role to play in terms of trying to push Pakistan, to push the Taliban, to give up Osama bin Laden. A very complicated story.
Well, it's just interesting, isn't it, when you start to parse nationalities. All but one of them were from Saudi Arabia, right?
Right. But you have all the issues of trying to figure out how you deal with the Saudis that we needed for all the actions that were taking place in Iraq. And that's why I think it's very important for the next president to understand the context of how all these issues fit together.
Understood.
And for the American people also.
This sounds like a gross question. Please don't interpret it that way. But professionally, are you glad you didn't have to grapple with this?
No, I'm not. No, I would have. Well, we did grapple with various parts.
I mean, post 9/11. You weren't the Secretary of State on the 11th of September.
It's an interesting question. I haven't thought about it that way. I loved being Secretary of State. I would have happily grappled with it with the team that we had.
Amazingly, your father taught Condoleezza Rice in college, correct?
Correct.
I want to take some phone calls. Madeleine Albright is in our studio. Put those headphones on, if you will, Madam Secretary, and we'll go to your calls now. Kurt's in Arlington Heights. You're on WGN. Hi, Kurt.
Hi, John. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Madam Secretary, could you confirm or deny that when bin Laden was in the Sudan offered bin Laden to the U.S.?
They did not offer bin Laden to the U.S. I can tell you that, and we wouldn't have been so stupid to turn it down if they had.
How does this story exist? Why is that told?
I don't know. I think part of it exists because there are certain people that lobby for Sudan that are trying to make this story have legs. It just does not. And Sudan, there's no question that Sudan was an area where bin Laden was able to roam around. If you remember, we actually bombed a pharmaceutical plant in Sudan that we thought was connected with bin Laden. But that's how the story, it's been denied many times, and it's simply not true.
Was there an instance where they had bin Laden literally in the crosshairs, and Clinton was asked if he wanted the trigger pulled, and he said no?
That also is one of those stories. I mean, whenever we had the possibility of getting bin Laden, when there was actionable intelligence and we really knew we could get him, we made every attempt to do that.
This is Tom in Chicago. You're on WGN. Hi, Tom.
Hi, John. Thank you, Madam Secretary, for taking my call. And I want to ask this in a respectful fashion, because I do respect the job that you did. But since you and Bill Clinton, or since the Clinton administration in which you served, had, and I'm trying to be judicious here, but a less than stellar track record in the 90s with regard to downsizing the military and our own intelligence capabilities. And that report was from George Tenet, who certainly is no friend of George Bush. But and with regard to how the terrorist, certain terrorist acts were treated by the Clinton administration, almost as police actions.
What's your question, Tom?
Well, the embassies in Africa and the attack on the coal. Well, why you have this book now that is offering suggestions for the president-elect? Why should we take this advice if we?
Sure, that's an interesting question, Tom. Thank you for asking. And really, we're short of time. I want to hear what
you
have to say.
Well, I have to say, I'm not saying that everything we did everywhere was correct. And one of the things that I talk about is that it took a little longer than it should have for President Clinton's first administration to get organized. We had discussions. It was hard to figure out how to come to decisions. And so that's why I'm saying that it's very important to learn from not only our mistakes, but those of other presidents. I do think that we did a pretty good job on a whole host of issues. I'm very proud of how we stopped.
But in retrospect, would you have acted more decisively? Would you have acted more militarily in some of these instances?
I think the issue here is that we did not have the kind of intelligence that would have allowed us to use more force on terrorists. Because part of the question, this is the thing that people have to remember, after 9/11, it seemed okay to carpet bomb Afghanistan in order to try to find where Osama bin Laden was. And people need to remember that before 9/11, they thought President Clinton was crazy when he launched cruise missiles against Afghanistan.
Former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright's in Chicago. Back in Chicago, she hails from these parts. Memo to the President-elect is her latest book. Well, I shouldn't say hails from these parts because you weren't born in the United States. It was Prague?
I was born in Prague, and then we came to the U.S. in 1948, but I lived here in 1960 and 61.
Your husband wrote for the Sun-Times?
Correct,
yeah. Back to some phone calls. You be short with your answers. They'll be short with the questions. We'll try and get through a few more. Madam Secretary, Mike's in Elk Grove. You're on WGN. Hi, Mike.
Hi, John. I'm just curious. When Obama and Hillary appeared on the scene, I think it's going to be a Democratic year because we've had enough of the Republicans in the last 7 years versus what Bill Clinton did for eight. And I thought for sure that Hillary would take the lead and Obama would wind up as VP, and that would give him the experience that he lacks right now to keep it Democratic for 16 years. One of my employees said to me, well, don't be negative on Bush because the war in Iraq is helping us with the recession that we're now facing. And I just was astounded by that comment.
Do you have a reaction to that?
Well, I'm astounded by the comment because the war in Iraq is damaging our reputation, but most of all killing Americans and Iraqis and not solving anything. The surge itself, militarily, has in fact worked because our military is great militarily, but the political situation hasn't improved, and so I find that a ludicrous argument, if I may say so.
Thank you, Mike, for the call. But Lynn in Highland Park, you wanted to know about the surge too, right?
Yes, I did. And by the way, it's an honor to listen to you, even Madam Secretary.
Thank you.
And thank you, John. Yes, and I was actually calling because I read an article in the Journal today, co-authored by Joe Lieberman and John McCain, saying about the surge, that the surge was working, but it needed to be sustained, and I wanted you to comment on the surge and whether you thought it was working. We all know it's a little bit late, but...
Well, it is working. I mean,
well, it's working militarily, because our military is incredible. I have the greatest admiration for our troops.
How is it failing?
It's failing because what it was supposed to do was to provide an environment for the politicians of Iraq to come up with some kind of agreements and coalitions, and they're not doing that.
They're not doing that. Well, then, that's not an argument to not have initiated the surge, is it? Do you suggest pulling out more so would have fostered that environment?
I think there is the idea that if they actually had to do things themselves instead of just relying on us, that it might have, you know, we're not there forever to run you.
Well, aren't you the compassionate conservative? I mean, so you're saying tough love here. Let's pull out and they have to do it on their
own.
This
is what I think. I think that other countries should be able to help us in training the Iraqis because they want to run their own country. Their politicians need to come to some agreement. They need to agree on their oil laws. And we have to systematically get our troops out of there.
Thank you for joining us. It's been a fascinating hour. Do you come back through Chicago very often?
I'm always happy to, and I love being on your show, John.
We'd love to have you back. Madeleine Albright, Memo to the President-elect is her latest, and it's for us voters, really, because there's only 37 people running for president, and it's down now. Bill Richardson is out, so it's really sort of a primer for all of us on what has happened in the past and how better to gauge your next vote. Thank you for coming in.
Thanks a lot, John.